Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Deanne Stillman, a noted writer. Her latest book is Mustang, The Saga of the Wild West, Wild Horse in the American West. And she has written so much for Truth Dig and for Rolling Stone and Slate and many other publications, and joins us here today on the air. And Deanne, welcome. Pleasure to have you with us.
Hey, thanks very much, Mark. Really a pleasure to speak with you and be on your excellent show.
I'm also happy that my wife turned me on to your work. So that was one of the presents she's given me in the past year has been Mustang. So,
oh well, cool. You know, one of the best things that's happened to me since my book has come out is that I shouldn't even say the book. It's Wild Horses have led me to the most interesting people and to, you know, many kindred spirits around the country. And I really think it's because of the subject matter of Mustang, and that's the Mustang.
Right. Absolutely. That's funny. You know, it's such, in many ways, a simple but complex subject. I mean, if you think about the way most people perceive the wild horse,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's amazing. Leading up to this show, isn't the conversation we're having together? I've had conversations, and Valerie's had conversations with people that we know well, and almost to a person, maybe 4 out of 8 of the people we spoke to said, but aren't they pests? Aren't they, like, in the way? Don't we have to cull the herds? Don't we have to put them aside? I mean, this is something from the past, and they're just taking up our space, or pests, or stopping ranching, whatever. But that is, I think, a very popular perception of the wild horse, no matter how romantic one feels about its past.
Well, I think it is a widespread perception, but I think a lot of people don't understand what's at stake here, or they don't understand exactly who the Mustang is, and what its role has been in the making of America. And as I say in my book, it doesn't get more American than the wild horse, and without the wild horse, we wouldn't be here. You know, we're a country that worships freedom. The word appears numerous times in all of our founding documents, and it's a mantra that we all hear growing up. It's a free country. I can do what I want. We have a Bill of Rights. We have freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and on the list goes. But the one animal that most represents freedom, you know, the one that with the mane and tail
mm-hmm.
flying in the wind, is the wild horse. And with all due respect to the eagle and other wild animals, that's really the one animal that is most American is the wild horse. And that's what's at stake here, the animal itself and the heritage that it represents. And that's really what my book is all about. I tell the story of the wild horse on this continent from prehistory in its evolution here through the present. And, you know, it doesn't get, as I said, doesn't get more American than this horse. The horse itself is North America's gift to the world, which I think is something people don't realize. It evolved on this continent. It headed north across the Bering Land Bridge, populated the rest of the world, meanwhile went extinct here, but returned with conquistadors in 1519. And that's my first chapter, the
yes,
return of the Mustang to this continent and its role in opening up the conquest.
You have a wonderful piece in here that in that chapter that struck me, which was something that happened 2 months after the Battle of Little Bighorn and the surviving horse Comanche. And you have this piece in here by Thomas Huxley of the famous Huxley family,
mm-hmm.
and what he said about that event and the horse itself.
Yeah. Yes, I'm just let me backtrack for a sec to Comanche the horse. Comanche was was billed as the lone survivor of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And, of course, there were many Native American survivors, but he became a superstar of the era. I recount the story of the Battle of the Little Bighorn by way of equine service in my book. And Comanche was a wild horse who was pressed into service during the Indian Wars of the 19th century. During the Civil War, 1.5 million horses and mules died either in battle or of illness. And so what happened around that time was that the cavalry turned to the vast wild horse herds of the West, you know, for remounts. And Comanche was one of them. Comanche came from what was what used to be called the Great Horse Desert in Texas. And that's all you had to say to people to mm-hmm. get there. If you said, I'm going to the Great Horse Desert, people would know exactly where it was. This, you know, huge area in Texas where vast rivers of horse, as Native Americans used to say, were running. And that's where Comanche and a number of other horses were taken from. And he, you know, was trained by the cavalry for use in battle and ultimately made his way with Custer's unit to the Little Bighorn battlefield. And after Custer's unit was wiped out and General Terry's unit came onto the field the next day and everybody was wondering, hey, where's Custer? And they found Custer's unit surrounded by dead horses. What happened there, I think this is one of the little-known pieces of American history. Custer's men killed their horses as protection, for final protection when they were going down, and that's where they made their last stand, from inside this breastwork of horses. And out of the carnage, the day after the battle, stumbled the wild horse Comanche. By the way, he was named because he had survived a number of previous battles, and one of them was a battle against the Comanche Indians. And he was, when his handlers went to him after that battle, they found that an arrowhead was embedded in one of his flanks, and when they went to remove it, he exhibited such great stoic courage that he was named Comanche in honor of the tribe that the army was fighting that day. So at any rate, out of this carnage stumbles Comanche, and once again he's wounded, and he was hit like 7 or 8 or 9 times with bullets and arrows, and it seemed like he was on his way out, but one of the men noticed that he had a will to live, and then somebody else poured some booze into a hat and gave him a drink, and from that moment on he became something of an alcoholic, actually, and survived and was able to, I think he was anesthetized by that, and he was able to hobble back to a nearby ferry, and they took him back to, one of the forts up the Yellowstone River, and nursed him back to health, and he became a superstar of the era. That's how he became billed as the lone survivor of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and he was retired with full honors, and given free rein at the, you know, at this fort and so on, and became a huge attraction for tourists, and was really kind of a superstar of that era. So here we have one of the most famous figures and pivotal figures of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, you know, a little-known figure in American history, you know, he's one of the reasons I wrote my book, as I was saying. I mean, this is what's at stake here. When people say Mustangs are pests, or, you know, right, they're taking up too much space, the descendants of the historical and spiritual and perhaps even direct descendants of Comanche are the horses that are still roaming the range today. And this is what we're losing now with these ongoing wars against the wild horse, and you know, more than our own heritage, theirs. They have a right to be here. That's what the 1971 law that Richard Nixon, of all people, signed protecting them says. They must be considered where they are found, and you know, they were here before we were.
There's so many pieces in this book that really, really kind of grab me because of the way you write it and the story you tell. But I want to jump into a piece first before we go back into history and come back to where we are.
Sure. Sure.
Which is what happened to you and what happened in 1998 that really pushed you in the direction of devoting your life to putting this book out.
Oh, yes, I'm glad you asked about that. And since we're talking around Christmas time and
yes.
New Year's, yes, 13 years ago, when I was finishing up my previous book, 29 Palms, about two girls who were killed by a Marine after the Gulf War in 29 Palms, California, I was sitting in a desert bar waiting to meet with a source, and I picked up a local paper, and there was an item that said, six wild horses had been gunned down outside Reno. And this was like right around Christmas time. And I was completely shocked, of course. And then a couple of days later, there was another item that said 12 wild horses had been gunned down outside Reno in the Virginia Range. And then by the end of that year, 1998, actually on New Year's Eve, there was another item that said 34 wild horses had been found dead in the Virginia Range, and they were also victims of this massacre. And that night, on that New Year's Eve, the ticker tape ran across the billboard at Times Square, you know, just before the ball was falling, ringing in the New Year. It said 34 wild horses gunned down, you know, in the Virginia Range. And by then, I was just completely overcome. The story is horrifying on its face, but more than that, I had grown up around horses. My mother was one of the first women in the country to ride professionally on the racetrack as what they used to call an exercise boy. And I was always quite struck by the horse's service. And my mother and sister and I would spend a lot of time at the track and around these amazing animals, thoroughbreds, of course, and just watch them running their hearts in, you know, day in and day out for little or no reward. And then at the end of it, you know, some of them would at one point or another be trucked to the slaughterhouse, although we didn't know that at the time. So I, at some point along the line, I had told myself I wanted to repay this favor that horses had done for my family, which was providing us with a living.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how I would do that, but when I found out about this massacre, a lot of things came together for me. I had to know what happened to these wild horses. And also the story was in line with the things I like to write about, war and peace on the modern frontier. A couple of weeks after I had seen the last item about the 34 wild horses, there was an arrest. And two of the three men arrested were Marines, and one was stationed at 29 Palms. So that was another piece of the puzzle that fell in for me. I knew a lot about that area. And so it just was one other something else that told me I needed to tell this story. And I knew after all of these things after I learned all of these things that the story of the Mustang would be my next book. I mean, I just had to find out, what were wild horses doing outside Reno? I had no idea that they were living in the Virginia Range.
Mm-hmm.
Who would kill them? Why did that happen? And it all went from there. And once I started looking into the incident, I found that it was a very big story that went everywhere, just like horses themselves.
What you've written is a very powerful story. I think people don't realize a few things, and don't realize a lot until they read some of your articles or read this book, that up until the late 19th century, as you write, there were close to 2 million wild horses in the United States of America.
I know people, again, I didn't learn this growing up. We all know about the buffalo and how those herds were massacred, but the big question my book asks is, why are we, a cowboy nation, destroying the horse we rode in on? And that's what I learned when I went back and started and tried to understand, you know, this character, actually. Who is being gunned down in the mountains outside Reno? I found out, as you say, that there were countless horses running the range at the end of the 20th century. They returned to this continent with conquistadors. That's the story I tell in my first chapter.
Right.
When I say returned, I know some people disagree with me on that, but they are native to this continent. They, as I said, they went extinct here and returned, and they have been linked by way of mitochondrial DNA by peer-reviewed scientists to the horses of the Ice Age. And they are considered by scientists to be reintroduced native wildlife. So they returned with conquistadors, just 16. And you know, so many horse, just 16 with Cortez, let me be specific, during the first entry into this continent. I recreate his march into the jungle with the first, with the horses of the with those first 16 horses, and one by one they fell as they encountered Aztecs and jaguars and, you know, all other sorts of perils. But there's a can I just read the last paragraph of that chapter?
I'd love that. Please do. Please do.
Okay. The record tells us that the original 16 horses that came with Cortez, the two bays, the light bay with the three white feet, the piebald with the black markings, El Morzio and the others, perished during the early years of the conquest, and so too did the 350 that came with De Soto, according to history. But there's a legend that says otherwise. It says that the foal born to the brown mare en route from Spain survived, escaped at some unknown time, and ran toward its ancestors over mountains and across valleys and canyons and rivers, through cloudbursts and dust storms and days of no water, left to carry on by jaguars and wolves and snakes, perhaps aided by animal spirits, particularly chattering birds, that urged the foal onward as it grew older, and eventually finding its own kind. Six horses that are said to have escaped the De Soto campaign and moved westward. This small band, too, had traveled great distances across wetlands and then into the parched flats just beyond the Rio Grande. Like the foal, getting a reprieve from predators, or perhaps not appealing to them for reasons that we do not know, drawing ever closer to the American West, possibly sensing in their bones and marrow that one of their own was waiting for them, needed their kinship, and it was in the Sonoran Desert, possibly, or the Mojave, that one day the six happened upon the one, drinking at a depression in a canyon rock, or grazing on some rabbit brush, and then they exchanged some information and headed for Freedom El Norte, their home. So the horses that descended from those horses and others who later joined them were among the millions running the range at the end of the 20th century. And those are the horses that as I said, you know, with the Comanche story, they fought our wars during the frontier era. They opened up cattle trails. I recount in my book in a chapter about cattle drives how thousands of horses went up the trail from Texas through Kansas and beyond with cattle, and of course were, you know, the cowboy's great partner. Then when the frontier closed ultimately and the buffalo had been wiped out, there were all these horses left, and you know, Native Americans had been moved on to reservations, and their numbers, their populations greatly reduced. And by the way, I should say that in the end, the only way that the government, the U.S. government, could defeat the tribes was to strip them of their ponies. I mean, they realized that that was the thing that had to be done in order to deprive them of their transportation and effective manner of waging warfare. And really in order to destroy their spirit, and something I recount in my book, in my chapters about the Native Americans and the horse and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, is this war that was waged against the tribes and their ponies. There were great massacres of Indian ponies carried out during the 19th century by the government. Thousands of ponies were taken and in some cases mowed down. That was a government order. And when that was done, when the tribes were dismounted and decimated, then it was over. But there were all these horses running, you know, still a number of horses, as I said, running wild, and people began to look to them as a cash crop. They were no longer needed. The car was invented by the end of the 19th century. The train. Nobody needed the horse for transportation anymore. Speaking generally here, I don't mean nobody. And people turned to them as began to be viewed as a cash crop. That's when rodeo arose around that time, a little bit earlier. They began to be viewed as entertainment and a cash crop. Thousands were sent to the slaughterhouse that rounded up very cruelly.
And this began in the late 19th century?
This began in the late 19th century. As the frontier was closing up. And, horses became less necessary. That's when you see the demonization of the horse start to happen. They're referred to as outlaws and sons of bitches. Some of that comes out of rodeo literature.
Mm-hmm.
Pests, varmints. Suddenly they're not so romantic. They're varmints and need to be exterminated. And that's what happened after the tribes were stripped of their ponies. Then we began turning on ourselves by way of our Mustangs. And that's what one of the things I document in my book. And I think that's another thing that a lot of Americans don't understand when they say things like, well, they're just a bunch of pests.
Right, right.
You know, not really. And they are indigenous to this country. And without them, we have no America. One other thing I should add on this point is that, you know, the famous Longfellow poem about Paul Revere's horse, Paul Revere's Ride.
Right.
But of course, it's about the horse that he rode. I went back into the record and found out that that horse had a name. I talk about this in my book, and her name was Brown Beauty. She had wild horse bloodlines. And after the ride, the poem ends, you know, of course, in a victorious moment. And, you know, and it's a fantastic poem, and we all learned it growing up. But if you go beyond the poem's ending, you found out that the horse was taken by the British after the ride and galloped. One British soldier ran off with her and galloped for a while, but she was spent, and she collapsed at some point and died.
Mm.
And that's the horse. That's the horse who birthed America, Brown Beauty. You know, War Horse is playing on Broadway now, and the movie's coming out.
The movie comes out Christmas Day.
On Christmas Day. But these are the war horses of America, the horse we rode in on. And a lot of them were once wild, and that's what's at stake here.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. This book that you wrote, Mustang, one of the things you mm-hmm. do here is take us on this journey, this historical journey, through so much. I mean, whether it's little things in here to grab me, like the story of, if I remember this right, the story of Lone Wolf, who was died in England and his remains brought back, and the whole idea that how the Wild West, quote-unquote Wild West, kind of captured the imagination of the world, with these Wild West shows that went all through Europe, and the rodeo beginning, and the whole world of Hollywood, and the role that the horses played in Hollywood, and it's amazing how integral the horse was to our imagination.
It is amazing. I mean, every aspect of our being here, and our survival, and our imagination. The horse has fueled our dreams in every way. The horse helped. The horse facilitated the invention of the movies, as I document.
Right.
The horse was Hollywood's first celebrity in silent movies. And by the way, just to respond to your comment about Lone Wolf was a Native American who was one of the stars of the Buffalo Bill shows and who traveled with Buffalo Bill to England and then Scotland, and then they went to Europe and, you know, France and Italy and so on. And a number of the people who traveled with the Buffalo Bill shows were surviving Native Americans. Sitting Bull and Black Elk went as a young boy. But of course, some of the most popular stars of the Buffalo Bill shows were his horses, and people, he had favorite horses, and a lot of people came just to meet, not to meet Buffalo Bill, who was, of course, a huge superstar, but to meet the horses. And I document in my chapter about Buffalo Bill the crossing, one of his transatlantic crossings, and also what happened to one of his beloved horses en route. And I don't want to give that story away.
You want people to buy the book and read it.
Thank you, Mark. Hey, that reminds me, maybe now you could talk about some of the reviews that my book has been getting.
We've been getting incredible.
Set it up.
Yeah.
What?
I've been reading them all, too, as well, from Orion and many of the magazines. I mean, it's a very powerful book.
Thanks. But it's an L.A. I would like to point out that it was named by the Los Angeles Times as the best book of 08. It won the California Silver Medal Book Award for nonfiction. It's gotten great reviews in many publications. Orion, The Economist, The Cleveland Plain Dealer, The Santa Fe New Mexican, The Arizona Star. It's partly under option for a film now, starring Wendy Malick as Wild Horse Annie, one of the characters in my book.
I was going to ask you about Wild Horse. Talk about her in a moment. Lead up to this.
Okay,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It took me 10 years to write. I should point that out too. It's a big epic story, and it was a 10-year-long trail.
It was. I mean, I think, mm-hmm. It's a magnificent story. I think that people need to kind of really hear it and wrestle with it and realize where we are today. I mean, because this year, 2011, and things that you mentioned in your book, this is the 40th anniversary of Richard Nixon signing the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act. It's also
right.
50 years, if I have it right, from the great movie. Why am I blocking the name of the movie? It just came to me and left.
The Misfits.
Yes, The Misfits. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I mean, of The Misfits.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that.
And so these two are kind of really epic events, both in terms of how we view the horse and what Richard Nixon did. Because I think people forget that. Despite all of his, as you've written, all of his kind of evil ways and what he did to this country, he was also, perhaps one could say, he was our greatest environmental president. This was part of it.
I know. It's really strange. Of all people, the paranoid, sweaty Richard Nixon, who actually, you know, we have this idea that, you know, Ronald Reagan was a cowboy in the White House and you know, there we've seen all the images of George Bush the second, you know, clearing brush at his ranch in Texas and all of that. But really, it turns out the one true cowboy in the White House in the modern era, in terms of being a loyal partner to the horse, was Richard Nixon. Because he signed the legislation that you mentioned, the 1971 Wild Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act. And that was something that Wild Horse Annie, an intrepid Nevada figure, had battled for herself for 20 years. she was a Nevada secretary, and one day on her way to work in 1950, on a highway in Reno, she saw blood spilling out of a truck, and she followed it down a remote highway, and then the truck came to a halt, and she watched in horror as these dying and bloody Mustangs were being offloaded at a slaughterhouse. And she herself had grown up in Nevada and had heard stories about such things. And as I mentioned earlier, there had been Mustanging going on there for decades and across the West, and it was legal. It was perfectly legal, into which the movie The Misfits gets into, the famous movie starring Marilyn Monroe and Clark Gable,
right,
about Mustangers, or men who round up wild horses for a living, and I used to sell them to the slaughterhouse for dog food. But Wild Horse Annie was kind of the figure that Marilyn Monroe plays in a way. She saw this terrible scene, these horses being, at death's door and then being offloaded at this plant. And she went back, after seeing that, her life was never the same. She went back to her office and, the story immediately began looking into what was going on, and the story overtook her life in a lot of ways, just as it did mine. I mean, once you run into these scenarios, it's hard to turn away. She embarked on what was a 2-decade-long campaign to battle for protections for a Mustangs and burros too. I should say those are part of her campaign and are included in the bill that protects wild horses. And that's the last section of my book. It's called They Also Served, and it's about the role of the burro in the making of our country. But so Annie battled, just with great commitment and dedication until she won protections 4 times, first at the county level where she lived in the Virginia Range, then at the state level in Nevada, and then twice on the federal level. And this last bill in 71, the one that's been eroded over the years, was the one that Nixon signed. And he, oddly enough, quoted Thoreau at the signing ceremony. He said, "We need the tonic of wildness," which we do. And he got that. He signed a number of other pieces of big, important environmental legislation. And he seems to have had a shadow side. For a lot of us, the shadow side is dark, but I think in his case, his shadow was very light, and he was afraid of it, and he spoke up on behalf of wild horses in a big way. There was more to his speech, which I quote in my book. And really, without him and Wild Horse Annie, we would have no wild horses today. And here we are, at a critical time when wild horses, we had 2 million at the end of the 19th century. Maybe we have 30,000 or something left on the range today in the western states. Texas, which once had the Great Horse Desert, as I mentioned, has no wild horses, period. I mean, this is like the birth of the cattle drive, Texas is. No wild horses running there at all, period.
Most of them are left are in Nevada now, correct?
More than half of the country's wild horses are in Nevada.
And some are in Wyoming and some in Montana, but mostly Nevada.
Montana, Arizona, Nevada, California, Idaho, Oregon, Washington. But yes, more than half in Nevada, and that brings me back to the Virginia Range. That's the horses who were, when I first got into the story in 1998, 13 years ago, the horses that I had heard about were from the Virginia Range, the first herd that Wild Horse Annie battled to protect, and they're still under siege now, surrounded on all sides by freeways. And they're on state land. A lot of the other herds that I talk about in Mustang are on public or federal lands. And when the 1971 law went into effect, that law designated 303 herd areas, which are the places where all the different herds were found there were 303 different areas with 303 different herds. Now we're down to about 198 or even fewer. That means over 100 herds have been zeroed out in the parlance of wild horse.
And now we're bringing back the slaughterhouses.
It means they've been totally removed.
And now we're bringing back the slaughterhouses.
Well, yes. I mean, that's kind of a murky area because not all of those horses are sent directly to the slaughterhouse. They're not rounded up for slaughter. They're rounded up and pressed into the Bureau of Land Management manages, which is a federal agency that manages most of our country's wild horses. Most of the wild horses that are rounded up are sent into the Bureau of Land Management's adoption pipeline and ultimately readied for adoption to the public if adopters meet certain qualifications. The pipeline is kind of a mess and has been from day one. Too many horses rounded up for too few adopters. Some of the holding facilities, are, as I document in my book, are not well kept and very poor conditions. And some of them, horses have perished in these holding facilities because of disease, which spreads rapidly. Or, in one case, I read about something that happened at a Nevada facility a few years ago, and this is in my book as well, a little-known incident in which six horses died of thirst after supposedly being rounded up on account of the drought, but then the person taking care of them at the facility forgot to turn on a water spigot and they died. There's all sorts of negligence that goes on at these places to the horses' great peril. I should say that some of this doesn't always happen, and there are plenty of horses that get through the pipeline and they're fine and they're adopted and they end up with kind owners and, in the hands of people who care about them. And there are fantastic stories involving Mustang adoptions all over the country, and Mustangs are serving at the border with, border patrol units and various equestrian units and law enforcement around the country. And as I say, many individuals have stepped up and are taking great care of them, but there just aren't enough adopters, and some are cruel and end up selling them at some point to slaughterhouses. Although this is illegal, but there's just no way to keep to control all of it. There are too many horses in the pipeline, as I said, and not enough oversight. Again, I mean, horses are still a cash crop for a lot of people, and they end up. wild horses do end up being sold to slaughter, although that's not legal. There was a mandate passed a few years ago under the Bush administration that said horses over 10 or not adopted on the third try could be sold to the lowest bidder, which meant the slaughterhouse. And I talk about that in my book, too, how that all came about and how it was stopped. And it's presumably not happening now, but there are plenty of horses falling through the cracks, and there are more roundups planned for 2012. And I've been calling for years. I've been writing op-eds about this in the LA Times and elsewhere, and I've covered the situation on Slate. I've been calling for a long time, and I do in my book and at my talks around the country, for a temporary moratorium on all roundups pending a complete overhaul of the federal government's wild horse management policies. And other people have been calling for this as well. I mean, Senator Mary Landrieu tried to do this a couple of years ago, and Representative Raul Grijalva in Arizona and Ray Hall in West Virginia. Some major political figures have stepped up here as a result of a public outcry. All slaughterhouses in this country were shut down by legislative mandate a few years ago. The House recently voted to reopen them. Obama has come out and said that that won't happen, and due to state laws in the states which have these plants, presumably they can't be reopened all that easily, although there is now a move afoot to try to do so. And that of course affects all horses, you know, any horse that ends up being sold to buyers for, you know, the slaughterhouses, kill buyers as they're known, until those plants, well, let's hope that they don't open. Horses that go to slaughter are now being trucked across the borders into Canada and Mexico, which is legal, and there have been bills introduced that would prevent this trucking of horses across the border for slaughter, but the bills just end up being mired in committee after committee.
Because this is also part of the kind of great corporate ranching power in Washington, D.C.
That's part of it. It's much more complicated than that. I mean, there are a lot of people making money here. They're trying to make money, and corporate ranching is a part of it. I mean, there's overbreeding in the thoroughbred industry and the quarter horse industry. Oh, too many horses are bred every year and cast off. And as always, it's animals blamed for human behavior, and this is one instance of it. But to get back to the plight of the wild horse, I just want to let people know that you know, the wild horse is our great partner. No horse, no America. In the last chapter of my book, I talk about this massacre that we discussed when we first started chatting, and I ended up meeting a filly who survived that massacre named Bugs.
Bugs, right.
She was found a few days after all the horse carcasses had been discovered, and she was lying in a ditch and starving to death. A hiker in Nevada named Carol Abel had come across her and notified authorities, and then Betty Lee Kelly and Bobby Royal, who run a sanctuary called Wild Horse Spirit, were called to the scene, and they're often the first on the scene of various incidents involving Mustangs in Nevada, outside Reno, where they're based, and they helped to rescue Bugs and took her back to their sanctuary, Wild Horse Spirit, in Carson City, where they nursed her back to health, and she became my guide through this story, really. I wouldn't have been able to write Mustang without Bugs. I spent a lot of time with her during the 10 years that I worked on my book, and I just I give her a lot of credit for being there for me and a lot of other people and helping me through what was a very difficult and painful story to tell. She passed away 2 years ago due to an ongoing kidney ailment that was probably a result of her foundering in the gullies, shortly after that massacre, because she didn't have mare's milk. Her mother had probably been among the victims of that crime. But I want to read the last paragraph of my book to give people more of a sense of what's going on with our wild horses. In the higher elevations of the Nevada desert and in certain pockets across the West, Mustangs still roam, unfettered in pretty herds, each herd with its own story. The Serbat in Arizona, the Little Book Cliffs in Colorado, in Idaho, the Challis, the Kiger in Oregon, the Chemehuevi in California, the South Shoshone, the West Douglas, the Sinbad, the Cibola, the herd at Wheeler Pass, the Mustangs at Havasu, the Whistler Mountain horses, the Four-Leggeds of Jake's Wash, Choke Cherry, Clover Creek, Reveille, and Alamo, galloping, walking, grazing, trying to make more of their own, pawing through the ice in winter to scrounge for forage, appearing in the backyards of the new Levittowns that are replicating across the desert, straddling land where they are federally protected and land where they are not, spreading seeds so new grasses can grow, stopping for a drink, trying to cross highways, fleeing trappers, running from bullets, on they go, but for how much longer we cannot say. They really belong not to man, Will James wrote, but to that country of junipers and sage, of deep arroyos, mesas, and freedom. So that's what's at stake when any of your listeners hear about roundups coming up in the new year, and they ask about, hey, who are the, what's up with those horses? Aren't they just a bunch of pests? Not at all.
I wonder if, Dan Stone, if you could talk a bit about, I mean, what America, what people can do now. I mean, what can we, how do you wrestle with this, and why is it even important that the horses survived? You know what I'm saying? It still doesn't seem, it's on the forefront of people's minds who love horses, and a lot of people in a listening area who do, who are involved with them. But the real issue is, what can you do, and why is it important? I mean, people say, look.
It's important for all the reasons I lay out in my book. I mean, it took me 10 years to explain why it's important. So really, one thing I would do is suggest that people read my book.
I would do the same.
No, this is not just about selling books.
No, I said I would do the same. I think your
book
is
great. Oh, okay, sure. You know, you can get it from the library. I don't, you know, be great if you buy it. I'm a writer. This is what I do. But read it, get it at the library. Go on my website, deannestillman.com. Read my numerous articles on the subject. Beyond that, people can get involved with some of the groups I talk about in part three of my book, all the various wild horse rescue. Not all. I talk about many of them. The Wild Horse Rescue organizations around the country are talked about in part three of my book. I link to their websites. You can get involved on any number of levels. As I say, it's, a lot of it's enumerated in my book and on my website. So I would suggest, you know, doing all of the above, if people feel so moved, and then once they understand what's going on here, start contacting legislators and so on, and letting them know your thoughts. I mean, I did an interview about this Newsweek a couple of years ago, and they apparently got more letters on it than they had gotten, you know, on any subject, and you know, during that particular time period. I mean, it, and what I see at my talks is a very wide range of people. Once they understand what's at stake here, they want to get involved. I mean, I get people, I get Tea Party members and people on the far left. I get everybody, kids from 8 to 80, like cowboys, ranchers, teachers, nurses. I've had old Mustangers in their 80s, you know, guys who once made a living rounding up horses, and like the characters in The Misfits, rounding them up and selling them to the slaughterhouse. I've had them come up to me in tears apologizing for their role in the decimation of our herds, because they know when they look out their windows and now see a Walmart or a strip mall, everyone knows what has happened here. And that's who shows up at my talks. And I would say that, strange as this may sound, the wild horse and what's going on with it may be the one issue that cuts across all party lines. It may be the only one, because who doesn't like wild horses? And who doesn't thrill to the sight of a wild horse running free? And what American is going to tell you, no, I don't like Mustangs? And how come we named our greatest muscle car after the Mustang? It's called, why do we all want to drive a Mustang? And, you know, it was a calculated move on the part of Ford to call that car a Mustang.
Right, absolutely.
And it's got the pony on the grill. And I tell the story of how that campaign came about in my book.
Right.
And everybody, we Americans all understand this in our bones. And people want to preserve our heritage. If they only understood what's at stake, I believe that they would.
Dan Stillman, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you and have you with us for this hour.
Hey, thanks very much, Mark. I really appreciate your time and interest in American history.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.